So then they don't feel so bad heckling me. But then I have some professional hecklers in the front row, so that's a bit chancy. All right. So, not a bad collection today. As you know, I am Rocky. Yes, really. Have you guys ever seen me speak before? I know a couple of you have. Okay, are you expecting to see me hack into anything? Good. Okay, I haven't done that in a while. They, you know, did the whole, don't do that. So, all right. I am a technical evangelist in Azure and SQL. And my job is basically to get people revved up on Azure, as most of the evangelists you've heard speak are. I do work for Microsoft. My name really is Rocky. No, I'm not a boxer. Presenting with me today is Chris Zhang. She's going to help me with the hard part of the demos, since, you know, I don't do that. I draw boxes now. She can do the demos and the code. And we're trying to cover a topic today that seems to come up every time we turn around. How many of you have tried to move to the cloud already? Okay. Was it successful? You like it? Did data sovereignty come up for anybody? All right. How many people in here are architects and design level people? Okay. How many people here work for a government agency? How many people work for the AFP? Oh, no. Okay. All right. So this has become most relevant to people at government agencies or people that are dealing with data that might be considered private. And we want to address some of the issues and some of the questions that we've been getting a lot. As you can tell by my accent, I'm based in Canberra. So I work with government agencies. I'm working with Standards Australia on the cloud standards. Work with people like Ajimo, groups like that. And there's been a bit of a challenge getting across some of these issues. And the two things that usually come up when we talked about moving something to the cloud or taking advantage of the cloud is data sovereignty and security. Right? We're still very much in this mode of where we like to be able to go into the data center and grab our drive and rip it out of the sand and just see if it works, and then make sure we have our data, right? Have any of you tried that, just ripping a drive out of a sand? It's cool, isn't it? Usually it just works. I love that kind of stuff. And with Azure, we have kind of a unique situation where we're able to create these hybrid applications where we can take care of some of the data sovereignty and security issues by keeping data local. We're going to go into all that stuff very soon. So, security, to cloud or not to cloud, there are some things that do make good workloads and some things that don't. I'm going to try to show you some of those things and the things you might want to look at. All too often, people think this is an all or nothing thing, and cloud is not an all or nothing thing. Okay? We're going to look at about doing the right tool for the right job. And this kind of comes down to, do you need public cloud, private cloud, hybrid cloud, community cloud? Where's the workload fit? Where should it fit? And we'll look at doing that. And then cloud provider considerations. These are usually the big security ones. And the reason I pick these is because they're the ones I run into quite a bit. Now, feel free to ask questions during the session, okay? I didn't put a lot of slides together because usually it turns into a discussion, which is what I want to do if you have questions about it. And when we talk about data sovereignty, usually it comes down to two things. It comes down to 24/7 access to the data, making sure you always have access to it. And the other thing is, it's usually the foreign jurisdiction over your data. Who can go in there and get it, right? Who can look at it? So it's a privacy consideration. And we'll go into some details about these things. Is that cool? Everybody okay with that? Is there any concern that anybody else had that you want me to address, if I can? Ooh, this will be easy. All right. So, to cloud or not to cloud. Now, I've noticed that, and this has happened for the past 2.5-3 years. People think, oh, we're going to move to the cloud. So, first of all, I don't like the word move. I prefer to say take advantage of the cloud. Moving to the cloud implies you're going to forklift all of your stuff, shove it in somebody else's data center, and poof, it's going to work, and we trust them to do everything correctly. And it's not like that. There are some things that need to go in the cloud, some things that definitely do not need to go in the cloud. For example, I do not recommend you put anything above highly protected in somebody else's cloud, regardless of how secure they are, right? Doesn't make sense. There's no way the AFP, DSD, ASIO are going to put top secret stuff in somebody else's cloud. Okay? and I'm fine with that. But do you guys have these kind of workloads somewhere in your organization? So the top one over there, on and off. Does anybody have a period during the year where they spin up a bunch of servers for a particular task and then shut them off? A couple of you? A good example of this for me is the Australian Electoral Commission, right? Once every random amount of years, it seems, over here. I'm used to the very predictable November every 4 year kind of thing. But over here, you know, when the government calls an election, they may have 48 hours to get ready for an election, spin up all this capacity. When the election's over, it all goes away. That's an example of this on-off workload. And this can be very expensive. I was having a discussion with some of the AEC guys, and they said, you know, we've had occasions where we have procured, provisioned a server, it has gone out of support, been turned off and decommissioned before it was ever turned on. That's insanely expensive. So this is an example where if you could move that into the cloud, that doesn't happen anymore. You don't have to worry about that. You turn on the servers in the cloud when you need them. When you're done, you just shut them off. You don't have to pay for them. The next one is growing fast. An example of this is a new startup or climate change, the Department of Climate Change, an example of someone growing fast where carbon tax hit, they needed to spin up. This carbon trading scheme hits, they needed more capacity, monitoring, distributing data. So they're growing very fast. And they're usually, this is a case where you're growing at a rate that is faster than you can procure infrastructure. Right? So how, what's your average lead time for infrastructure? 5 weeks? How many of you can get a new server in Iraq within a month? That's pretty good. How many? 6 to 8 weeks. Longer? Oh, not bad. Not bad. I think the longest I ever heard, it took 18 and a half months to procure a single new server. And that happened to be at a state agency. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. By the time they procure the server, everything's changed. The app's changed, the requirements have changed, what they're going to do with it's changed. The chips are 486 now. It just doesn't work anymore. So you got to think about being able to rapidly provision things when you need it. That other workload down there, unpredictable bursting. This is stuff like emergency services. The Queensland floods, for example. A lot of the data centers got flooded. We needed emergency servers. Microsoft got together with some of our partners. We created some services in the cloud for them, spun them up. They use them to connect people who need stuff with people who have stuff and decommission it when it was done. Right? So that's an unpredictable burst, something you don't know is going to happen. And then predictable bursting. This is another really good example. Have you guys heard my favorite example already, the Domino's Pizza one? I like the Domino's Pizza example because there's one day a year when they take more pizza orders than the rest of the year combined. Any guesses what that is? Super Bowl Sunday. Absolutely. They take a ridiculous amount of pizza orders on Super Bowl Sunday. So about an hour before it happens, they spin up a whole bunch of servers in Azure, take all their orders for that day. About 2 hours after the Super Bowl, they shut them all off again. They only pay for them for that one day, that 6 or 7 hour period. So ATO could use this. If you think about the way the ATO does things, can you imagine tax submission, quarterly BAS or annual BAS statements? You could do this. Spin up the systems to allow people to submit their BAS and then spin them down outside that cycle. Now, almost every organization has something that fits one of these patterns. Right? May not be most of your stuff. It may only be a couple things. Or you have something that's public-facing websites, document submission forms. I always think of organizations like Doer, where they take application grants, education application grants, where they would have an ideal workload for this. So if you think about the types of workloads you could move to the cloud, see if you can find as many of those as you can. Now, if a workload contains top secret data that you're not even allowed to transmit over a public wire, SSL or not, it's not a candidate. That's fine. Leave it on premises. If there's a workload that, let's say you're moving SETI data or you're moving square kilometer array data and you got massive amounts of data going up and down the pipe regularly, that may be better local. Now, there are ways to deal with that that I can talk about later, but we're not trying to promote the idea that all of your stuff goes in the cloud. Pick and choose, okay? Now, right tool, right job. So cloud computing has a lot of advantages for a lot of different situations. And the idea of rapid elasticity, spin up, spin down when you need it, all of these things apply to almost everyone. You know, and even dev and test is a good example of this. You need some dev servers. You spin up an example of your environment in some virtual machines or in a cloud-based environment. When things are tested, move to production, you shut them down until you're ready to test again. So this might be a private cloud scenario. You don't need to do all your dev and test in Azure, although that is one of the more frequent requests we get. Can I spin up Azure virtual machines to do my dev and test on? Or to load test my system? Spin up a bunch of Azure clients and have it hammer your system, right? Be careful about that. You don't want to appear to be a DDoS site. So public cloud is for public things, right, in most cases. Where you're going to touch the general public, where you're going to touch someone outside your organization, you can think of at least moving your user interface and your business layer into the public cloud. Private cloud is for stuff where you want the advantages of cloud. You want rapid elasticity. You want cost savings. You want to get off of purchasing hardware and go into virtual machine land. You want the rapid up-down scaling. But, private cloud is also intra-agency. I didn't actually put it on the slide, but there's also community cloud, which is a private cloud shared across organizations. So if you think about it, in my world, if we look at the security agencies, could have a community cloud, the finance agencies could have a community cloud, and then a public community cloud or something for education, right? Where they can share the capabilities, share the data center, share the resources, but it's kind of kept within in their sphere of influence, okay? And then hybrid cloud. Hybrid cloud is one of my favorites because of the data sovereignty thing. With a hybrid cloud, you have some pieces in a public or shared cloud, and some pieces in your private cloud in your local data center. So we've worked very hard on making this possible. Sorry. The inevitable drink of water. So in a hybrid cloud, you're able to take advantage of the scale of, say, a public cloud. And oftentimes, and I'll talk about this in the security in a minute, about how you can increase your security posture by using public cloud, which really tilts some people's minds, right? I'm going to put myself in a public cloud and I'm going to be more secure? Yes. But that lets you take advantage of scale of where you're going to have the most touch points. If you think about where you get the most load, it's coming in on a lot of the servers, a lot of the public-facing servers. If you do have a public-facing website, or if you're the ATO, most people are going to be hitting these public-facing servers. It allows you to do that in somebody else's big capacity data center. But then you can keep the actual data at rest in your data center. You don't have to move all the data to the cloud. And we're going to go into detail on private cloud and show you a bit of a demo on how one of those sticks together in a minute. Well, a few minutes. All right. Now, security considerations. How many of you trust us? Hey, that's good. You all trust it. You wouldn't be here if you didn't, I suppose. When you're considering a public cloud provider, you need to consider, are they up to the task, right? And unfortunately, we haven't quite ratified the idea of a cloud provider certification yet. Now, there's organizations doing it. The Cloud Security Alliance is one of them. Standards Australia is putting together a standard with international organizations on a cloud provider status. And until that's done, we have to rely on existing standards that we know and love. This is like ISO. ISO 27001, 27002, the SAS attestations, PCI DSS, HIPAA, SOX, all these kind of things. Does your cloud provider do that? In our case, we have ISO, this is the ISO standard ticks. We have the SAS type 1 and 2, or SAS 70 type 1 and 2 attestations. And we just recently received the HIPAA certification from the U.S., which is the health insurance HIPAA, health insurance personal something information protection act. But it basically deals with medical records. So have they done the right thing? Have they done the regulatory compliance? Have they gone out to these organizations? Have they been audited? Are they audited by third parties? If they're not, If they haven't done that, maybe they're in progress. But if you look at your data centers right now, you did it for your data centers, right? Most of the government data centers are at least ISO certified. Some of them are DSD certified. I'm not sure if the DSD is actually going to go so far as to make a cloud provider, a publicly available cloud provider certification, but they are definitely checking them, definitely looking at them. You can also consider, do you trust a foreign piece of legislation? HIPAA, for example. We don't quite have one here that'll fit a cloud provider, right? A medical one that'll fit a cloud provider. But if you trust the US HIPAA regulations, okay, fair enough. You can trust ours because we have HIPAA. But that's up to you. Right? That's your choice. Most of you, anybody here from customs? Unless you're from customs, you're probably going to be dealing with Australian nationals' data, right? In 9 times out of 10. So you may or may not have to worry about dealing with foreign jurisdictions as far as regulatory compliance. Now, standards-based. And I'm not talking about the ISO standards and things. I'm talking about when you put stuff in their database, do they change it? Can you get it back when you're done? If you get it back, will it be in some form that you can't even recognize? Some people have run into this problem with a competitor of ours, where they put their stuff in their service, they were using it, they were running it, everybody was happy. And then when they tried to change servers, change providers, it took something like just over 2 weeks to get their data out. And when they got it out, it had been munged. It had been broken up way past normal data normalization and chewed up in a fashion that matched their servers, their provider's servers. So it wasn't even recognizable to them as their data when they got it back. And the provider didn't have a service to put it back the way it was. There's a particular provider that does that with data to optimize search. I don't need to tell you who it is, right? So think about that. Now, were any of you just here for Greg Losett's session? How many of you have been pretty much in this room since he started the Azure one? Is that okay? Do you like that idea, having all the Azure stuff in one room? Is that working? Or are you getting tired of these walls? Okay, because we thought we'd try that. And the reason I'm interested, I help run the Azure track, and I help run the security information management track. So I want to know what you think. So, when we think about these different providers, I often also get asked, what if I want to change? Can you guarantee me that there's a way to have a backout strategy? I say, absolutely. And I highly recommend whatever you plan, that you plan a backout strategy for your cloud implementation. Okay? You need to have this as part of any due diligence. It's, you may go with a local provider or a slightly smaller cloud provider that goes bust, right? Because everybody's trying to get into this cloud idea now, and there's all kinds of cloud service providers popping up in every street corner. It's looking a lot like the .com thing. So check it out, but have a backup strategy. If they do go bust, make sure they don't just pick up their hot dog cart and wheel it off. Make sure that they've got proper data retention policies, that they destroy your records when they're gone, after you get them back, right? So ask your cloud providers about that. If they don't have those things, if they haven't done the due diligence, if they can't treat your data with the same respect that you have to treat it, you might have second thoughts about it. Like how many of you here have had to go through ISO audits and things, right? ISO is one of those things where you have to monitor your suppliers. For you to be ISO compliant, your suppliers have to prove ISO compliance and blah, 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 blah. If they can't do that, your ISO compliance may go out of whack. So that's why the ISO ones are one of the first ones we went after. But think about your responsibilities and how your downstream suppliers is going to affect that. Now, all those things being said, taking all that into consideration, we feel that we've done the right things. We feel we've ticked the right boxes and we're doing the right things. Another question I've been getting asked recently is PCI DSS. Now, how many of you deal with PCI DSS? Okay, a couple of you. For those of you that don't, it's the Payment Card Industry Data DSS, Data Security Standard. Okay? if you are what they call a credit card data on file merchant, which means you take a credit card number and you store it, and you store the CCV, which you're not supposed to do, then you fall under PCI DSS. We get this asked this a lot because e-commerce websites and shopping sites are very popular cloud applications. I want to scale my new business to the world. I'm going to sell grandma's cookies to Ireland today. And you need to say, but I want to take credit cards. Wait a minute. Well, I'll just do it anyway. Well, don't do that. That's lawsuit territory. Right. Oh, nothing I say today constitutes as legal advice. Okay. I am not a lawyer. None of this constitutes legal advice. And I'm sure I got to say that again before I quit. So when you do this, people ask me, what about PCI DSS? And I say, well, to be honest, our systems are likely PCI DSS compliant. However, we cannot get a PCI DSS tick in the box because the PCI DSS audit process does not know how to do cloud. And this is another problem we have with standards and regulations right now that we're trying to get over. We're trying to work with all these standard bodies because even though the systems can probably do it, if you can't go through the proper audit process to actually tick the boxes, it doesn't count. So this is what we're doing with the Visa and the payment card industry and working on PCI DSS standards right now. Because a lot of PCI DSS systems, they have to take into account the moment you get the credit card data to what you do with it, store it, destroy it, et cetera. Well, that moment is when it hits your web page. When they punch in their little credit card number in the text field on your web page, you are now in PCI DSS land. So if you're not doing SSL and things in the application, you won't pass. We don't write the applications. Our data centers, our databases, our standards, our network, our servers, our processes stop at the application layer in the case of Azure. So this is one of the things they're having trouble with. How do you audit something when you only have half of it? So we're trying to work that through with them. Okay. So is there any questions about security considerations? Have I told you guys the 8-second rule? I'm going to totally blow this for questions today. The 8-second rule. If a speaker's up here and he asks, is there any questions, he counts to 8 in his head. And if there's no questions, by the time he gets to 8, there actually isn't anybody who's going to ask one. And the reason 8 seconds is because 7 seconds is an uncomfortable silence. 8 is too much. People break. So, all right. Security provider considerations. Now, sovereignty. This one is probably asked more than anything else, especially around Canberra. Data sovereignty laws. Wait. Data sovereignty law. Which one? The data sovereignty law. Which one? I don't know. What was that? Patriot Act. We'll get to that in a second. I'm glad somebody mentioned that. I love the Patriot Act because it is the most misunderstood piece of legislation on the planet. But I'll get to that. People think, and governments have been accused of misassuming this, that there is a law that says you cannot host data outside of Australian territorial boundaries. And there isn't one. That law doesn't exist. So people say, well, it must be in the Privacy Act. Well, actually, this is not legal advice. In the Privacy Act, Section 9, Subsection F says, yeah, go ahead. You can host data outside of Australian shores, foreign territory, providing you trust the provider to adhere to all of Australia's data protection rules and rights and laws and stuff. But you can do it. I haven't found anybody yet. If there is a lawyer in here or if there's a constitutional or some law genius in here who knows of a law that says you can't do it, please tell me, because I haven't been able to find one yet. And there was actually a study done that I'll refer to, and if you download the deck, the last slide after all that fluff at the end of it is a chart. I'll show it to you. Forgive the faux pas and turning off my slides. Okay. This is a chart of a study. Oh, you can't read that very well. Well, remember, it was for print. It wasn't for screen. Hogan Lovell did a white paper. And this is a comparison of about a dozen countries and their privacy laws, what it covers, what it doesn't, and things. And I think they did a really good job. They just recently updated this in July this year. And they went through there and they compared what different companies or countries' rules actually were, because they wanted to try to debunk this FUD around data sovereignty and around the rules and all this stuff. And they actually found, speaking of the Patriot Act, one of these, it's in the paper. If you download the paper, they mention it specifically. But they said, actually, the French powers of cross-jurisdictional prosecution and data retrieval make the Patriot Act look mamby-pamby. I thought that was kind of interesting. Nobody complains about the French, right? In that respect. And another thing I thought was kind of interesting is that in Australia, if a cloud provider is based in Australia, they do not have to notify you if they voluntarily give your information to a legal organization, like the AFP, Customs, ASIO, or whatever. They don't even have to tell you they did it, and they can volunteer the information if they suspect you may be naughty. The U.S. doesn't even allow that. The U.S., you have to have a legal court order process to cough up that information, and only to legal agencies. So when you do the chart and the straight across comparison, in actuality, the U.S. has better data protection laws than Australia when it comes down to privacy of data and stuff. I thought that was fairly interesting. But you guys can go through this chart later at your leisure. I'm sure it'll be good nighttime reading for you. Yes. It's legal for them to do that in cases where they believe you may be doing naughty things, which is kind of interesting. Now, there's a couple caveats to that. Like in the U.S., it says they have to get a court order to do it. Once they get the court order, then they can do it. And there's a lot of things like they don't have to notify you if you are the subject of an investigation until the investigation's over, by which point you're probably in chains. So, yeah, sorry. But that's another part of the anti-terrorist legislation that came in. So, yeah, this is the slide we were on, right? Is this one? Yeah, this is one. Legal access to data. This is where the Patriot Act comes into it. Do you know that the Patriot Act did not actually increase the United States' capability to access data? In fact, it didn't extend their jurisdiction. It didn't do anything where they can get more data that didn't already exist between what's called these MLATs, Mutual Legal Assistance, I think that's supposed to be a T, sorry, treaty. Now, what the Patriot Act did do is take the time it requires to get a subpoena to get this data from several days down to several hours, and only in the cases of a known terrorist investigation, a likely terrorist investigation. Outside of that, Patriot Act doesn't apply. So all it did is speed the time with which they can react to extract data. And I think that's kind of interesting as well, because a lot of people say, Data Sovereignty Patriot Act. Nope, sorry, I can't. But in actuality, it doesn't even apply, unless you're a terrorist organization. Okay, how many of you in here do belong to terrorist organizations? the AFP guy raises his hand. So you're really not going to have to worry about it. And to be honest, if it was a terrorist situation, the Australian government will cough up your data long before the Patriot Act enters into it because of these MLATs, these Mutual Legal Assistance Treaties. And these have been around for a long, long time. Did any of you guys remember a thing called the Hague Convention? I mentioned this last year, I think. There's a thing called the Hague Convention. And the Hague Convention is one of these MLATs. There was a guy in, I don't remember if it was Adelaide, or it was one of those flyover cities in the middle of the country. And you... Okay, I do fly to Adelaide once in a while, but usually fly over. He had a site of World War II memorabilia or something. He was a World War II buff. And he had some things on there from the Third Reich. That's Nazi, for those who don't know. And the Germans didn't like it. They thought it portrayed them in a bad light. Go figure. So what they did is they sued him. And they didn't even have to ask the Australian court's permission. They sued him in an international court and came in and took his computers because of these MLATs and stuff, way before the Patriot Act entered into the picture. So just to kind of level set things and to put some reality into this, it's nothing new, right? This isn't something we need to be afraid of, okay? And to be honest, this whole thing about data sovereignty is largely perception. That's why I wanted to do this session. We need to get over the perception that we have a data sovereignty problem. Yes, you should do the right things with people's data. Yes, the 1976 and updated Patriot Act, Privacy Act, says you need to protect the data. But the Privacy Act also says you need to be able to cough up the data for freedom of information, or so they can actually check the validity of the data you have on them. How many of you, if you collected data on any Australian citizens, if somebody walked into your office and pounded on the desk and said, I want to see every piece of data you have on me right now, how many of you could cough it up? How many of you could cough it up in a couple weeks? Yeah, it's going to take some time to put that stuff together, right? Maybe that's more of a data sovereignty problem to the individual than having stuff in the cloud. At least if I have my stuff in the cloud, I know I can get to it. Why? The SLAs. Yeah, big deal, SLAs. It just means if it goes down, we're going to pay you. Doesn't mean we can still get to the data. That's very true, right? So look at track records. I think I mentioned track records before. When it comes to let me finish this first. Got jumping around. I get excited about this topic. So protection of privacy rights, the Privacy Act. There's this thing about whose rights is it? Your laws or theirs? Right, what do we do? And in a lot of cases, you'll find that where the data sits has, in some cases, more ownership of the rights than where it came from. But in almost no case does where the data sit overrule the rights of where the data came from. Okay, and these MLATs and stuff help protect that chain of custody and the command and being able to get to your data and make sure that somebody doesn't abscond with it in the middle of the night. You know, and there's other things about, next slide. And that's the thing about whose rights are they? Whose data rights we're really concerned with? Are you concerned with your right to get to the data or their right to take the data? Which do you think is more important to your users? A foreign government's ability to take the data? Yeah? Or their right to be able to get to their data? You win. So you got outvoted by 3. Different users, exactly. That's the key, it's different users. Right tool, right job. If I am keeping a list of all 4 AZO undercover agents, sorry, it's like you have like 8 F-18s in the Air Force. It's incredible. That's not something you want escaping. So it's more important to protect the data and have access to it here. You're very concerned that another government will get a hold of that data. If it's information on a medical record, I can bet it's more important that whoever's hurt in a hospital in some other foreign land has access to their medical records. If they're dying in a hospital bed, disclosure is the least of their worries. Until they're better, then they want to sue people for disclosure. Right? If I'm healthy enough to sue you, I'm going to. So it's right tool, right job. All right. Think about how that would play into your particular situation. We found with a couple of our customers, like MYOB. You guys heard about MYOB? Maybe Purple Box and MYOB, yeah, okay. They're moving their system to the cloud. They're kind of changing from a shrink wrap product to more of a SaaS product with a local client data stored in the cloud. Now, what does MYOB hold? Accountant data, your personal finances. Yeah, that's important to me. I don't necessarily want that getting out, right? Although, you probably look me up, you know exactly everything about me by now. But I asked him, I asked their CIO, said, how many times has this come up? How many people have asked you, are you storing my data in Australia? And he said, nobody. They don't care. Well, that's cool. So how many of you have had a customer actually pin you down about data sovereignty when you started talking cloud? Some of you will have. Well, you don't count. You'll always get that problem, AFP man. You'll always get that problem. Oh, well, fair enough. Same situation. They're definitely going to ask you. Okay. Canberra, everybody asks me, right? And they usually say, oh, Patriot Act, big sovereignty. I'm like, okay, here, let's do this again, right? Somebody's going to ask, and you need to be prepared to deal with it. Now, if your customers are such that they really are not going to move on this issue, hey, okay, cool. Move your public stuff to the cloud, your public-facing website, whatever, your brochureware to the website. Keep their stuff private if push comes to shove. But chances are, in a lot of cases, when you're working with the general public, they're not going to care. Okay? Now, I'm not saying be cavalier about it. Don't just say, oh, they're not going to care. Go ahead. No, do some research. Find out. But don't panic. Yeah, don't panic. Carry on. Okay. Now, being able to access the data. This is all well and good. It's all cool. But this is the second half of the data sovereignty coin. I want to be able to get to my data at any time, at any point. How many of you in here are the IT pros that actually work in the data center? Okay. You five people are probably the only ones in here that can actually get to the data whenever you want. How many of you don't have access to your own data center? I don't, right? If something happened, if you want to get to your data, what are you relying on? You're relying on the data center operations team to make sure you can get to the data. Okay, so let's put it in perspective. It's the people who run your data center are the ones who enable your access to the data. How many of you contract out your data center operations? Most of the people in Canberra also do this. Big three-letter acronym organizations do this. They are dependent on a third party to provide access to their data by maintaining their database to a predefined set of standards, data center. We live with this situation every day. This is how a lot of large IT organizations work, including Fortune 500 companies, right? They entrust this operation to somebody else. So, now think about that. In a lot of cases, you've already given the care and feeding of your data to somebody else. What's different with a cloud provider? Other than location, we talked about location. What's different with a cloud provider? That's actually a legitimate question. I'm going to wait a little longer. Does anybody, what's different? Scale. Okay. I've never heard that before. That's actually a really good point. I hadn't heard that angle before. That's cool. Probably because I deal with the government most of the time. Anybody else? Scale? Are they going to be in business for long? I do hear that one quite a bit. You had one back there? Visibility of what? Yeah. In fact, clouds are literally made of fog. It's incredible. Yeah. Okay, so visibility. Are they going to be a business? And then will you get enough attention? Will you get the same amount of attention? That's good. Anything else? So these are good points, right? If I go with a big conglomerate like Microsoft and I have a problem, who from the big faceless Microsoft is going to care about my little bit of data? Good point. I can always stand up here and say, oh, I promise we will treat your data with the same care, respect, and love that we treat everybody else's data. And you're going to go, yeah, right. But in all honesty, it's true. And the reason that's true is because the way cloud data centers work is that your data is protected virtually. And depending on the scale you pay, it may be protected on its own rack. But it's not individual data things. We spread it out. We scatter it. And we do this to make sure it's always available and redundant and to prevent anybody from breaking into it, and then, you know, we have this chain of command, all this other crap that goes into it. There's like 12 layers of security around it. So your data is quite possibly intermixed in Iraq with somebody else's data. So if your data is, you know, underneath in this drive and over here in this drive and over here in this drive, and big customers are also in those same spaces, you are going to actually get the same love, care, and feeding as anybody else. Right? Now, it's when you call the help desk that's the issue, isn't it? Oh, crap. I did something silly. Can you restore my data? Well, depends on how silly it was. But that is where the SLAs and a different level of service comes into play. If you're somebody like MYOB, it behooves you to establish a premier agreement with an organization, right? Because your entire system is running on this, your entire livelihood is banking on this, and you have lots of it. Now, if you can't, large cloud providers, they're all going to be the same. You'll get the normal in the queue support, right? And I've got to be honest about that. I mean, it's the way it is. So it depends. Mission critical, cost your business, you might want to actually pay for the higher level of service. Right? So, but that is an excellent point. I hadn't heard that. The other two, cloudy, it's hilarious, foggy. Data visibility. So through the tools, through the APIs, through everything else, you should be able to see your data as well, if not better, than you can from a local data center. Right? I've seen a lot of data centers around here that are barely better than a shed with a peg for a lock. I went into a law firm one time. Said, okay, so where's your servers? Oh, it's here in the break room by the back door that the cleaners come through. Wow, you're a genius. So there's a good chance that our ability to let you access your data and see the data from a virtual standpoint is pretty darn good. Now, if you think about a physical standpoint, you know, you can stand at the window of the data center looking in longingly at your racks of servers with blinking lights. No, you can't do that with our data center. We're not going to let you. And the reason you can't do that with our data center is because we want to protect his data. Just yours, I promise. Right? So there is that. And it's a perception. I think it's safer if it's in this territory. Think about the perception. There's a really good chance our data centers are run to a much higher standard than almost all the data centers in Australia. I think there's only one data center here on Australian terra firma that is run to the same level ours is. Right? So, you know, I think that we kind of get through that one. And yours was remind me again? In business, are they going to be in business? Yeah, and that's what I mentioned earlier about the dot-com bubble. Are they going to be in business? Are they going to keep up? Think about that, right? If you go with the hot dog cart vendor on the corner with an extension cord running into somebody's trailer park, yeah, I would think twice about that data center. But chances are we're going to be around a while. Google's going to be around a while. Amazon's going to be around a while, right? But definitely think about their viability, right? Okay. Answers for these. All right. We're 3/4 of the way through the session, and we're 1/10 of the way through the day. No. Okay. The easy decisions. Between public and private is pretty easy. And if you go through this chart, these are kind of your easy metrics. Is it a public website or is it an internal B2B system? An internal or B2B system. Pretty easy decision there. Is everything on that site in the newspaper anyway? Yeah, make it public. Some things are better kept in the family. Keep that private cloud. If you want someone else to be the bodyguard, someone, the 800-pound gorilla wearing blue shirts in the room, okay, some of you, right? Think about public cloud. If you need that kind of high enterprise-grade internet capacity protection and capability without forking over as much money as we have, think about somebody else's cloud. But if you got it, great. If everything's in the family, trust is guaranteed on a different level. It's a personal level. It's a pink slip kind of level. Where with us, this is our stock in trade. If we can't maintain your trust, we do not have a business anymore. So it is in our top line, our best interest to make sure we do it well. Right? Now, if your IT budget comes out of your petty cash box, you might want to think about public cloud. right? Because we'll have more capacity. But if you have more money than us, cool. Build yourself a data center. I'd like to see it. I think it'd be pretty cool. Now, if it's in the public domain or you have no legal reason not to put it in the public cloud, consider public cloud. But if you do have some kind of validated legal or policy reason not to, do it. But don't take the FUD as just the de facto answer. That FUD, these legal reasons are really not as common as you think they are. It's perception. All right? We need to get over that perception. We need to stop the knee-jerk reaction. It'll make your lives a lot easier. So, some of the not-so-easy decisions. What if we need multi-authentication methods? How many of you let your users or end users authenticate with Facebook, Gmail, ADFS? Right? Was it easy?
Mildly easy.
Mildly, okay. Anybody else? Okay. Would you like to do that? Yeah. The cloud systems are built in such a way to enable that with minimal effort. I can spin up a multi-form authentication system really easy with Azure. Service bus relays are another way we start to look at this. If you want to get stuff from external to an internal service or from one service through your system to somebody else's service, set up service bus relays. It's just really a configuration exercise. Endpoint A, endpoint B, or here's a listener system. These people can subscribe to be listeners, and it's done. Very little code, mostly just a configuration thing, which can be PowerShell scripted. And then hybrid cloud. And hybrid cloud is the one we want to highlight today, which is where data actually does stay on premises, the data at rest. See, data in transit is not a big deal. We've been doing data in transit protection for years with SSL and VPNs and things like that. And to be honest, you can sit in our office in Canberra and you can try to reach the Department of Foreign Affairs across the street, and your request may actually go through Hong Kong anyway on its way across the street. So the data in transit really is a known quantity. It's a non-issue. This usually comes up where you have data at rest, data in the database, data in the files, things like that. With a hybrid application, you've got that. Data at rest stays in your data center. Okay? Now, multi-auth. We want to go with open standards as much as possible, which is another thing you should check out from your cloud provider. When you think about open standards, if they're using something extremely proprietary, it is going to be almost impossible for you to change providers or to bring it in-house or to do something else with it. You're looking at a rewrite. If they're going with open standards, like OAuth for authentication, you can put it anywhere and it's still going to work. Okay? So if we look at this, we have the access control service. And the access control service basically allows you to pick, like the bottom is the ADFS v2. It allows SAML type tokens from anybody with Active Directory to authenticate in your system. So they can come in with, you know, formerly known as Passport, Gmail, Facebook, Yahoo, into this WS Federation idea in an Azure Access Control Service. And we'll convert that into effectively, we can either do a pass-through on a SAML token if you're good with SAML, or we can convert it to these simple web tokens, which is the OAuth v2 standard, is simple web tokens. Now, has anybody ever seen a SAML token in print? A couple of you? They're like this big. And all it basically says is, here's my name, here's who authenticated me, when they authenticated me, here's when my ticket expires, and here's a list of my roles. But the thing is this big. An OAuth token that says the same things is that big and can fit in the header of the request. All right, so they're very efficient. So that's why people standardized on this. They call it a WRAP. Down here in the bottom it says WRAP. Web Resource Access Protocol is the way this thing works. And to do this, it's claims-based identity. You have somebody who validates who you are. They create a claim about you. They sign the claim. And you take that claim to the website, and you get information out of it. This is akin to a driver's license. When you go to the strip, the bars down here, you're going to end up, some of you who are young enough and pretty enough, will have to show your driver's license to get in. The club accepts that driver's license as a valid form of identity. But wherever you live in the States, your DMV, Department of Motor Vehicles, what do they call them here again? Not DMV. Road Transit Authority, RTA, they issue you the driver's license. So they're like the token provider. They validated you are who you say you are. They issue a license with your picture and some information on it, which are your claims, date of birth, address, you know, I was born in the 1900s kind of thing. And then the relying party is the club. They accept that as a valid form of identification. You become the relying party, and the thing you're accepting are these OAuth wrapped tokens given to you by an STS, which in this case is Facebook, Google, Yahoo, an Active Directory store. Okay? We make this really easy for you to start accepting this, because all you have to do is write your application once to accept these OAuth tokens. And when somebody new comes along, let's say you want to do Twitter authentication. You add the digital certificate from Twitter to your ACS site, and now you can accept Twitter logins as well. It's pretty easy. Right? And it's about 4 lines of code to put this in your application. Right? Server to server is the same thing. You can do this. Usually with server to server, you're going to use SAML anyway because it's already there and it's easier. It's built into the mechanisms. But we can allow you to do this and stretch your wings a bit with the access control service. So this is one thing. We've seen a couple people that this is all they want cloud for, to do this. And so that's all they do. They sign up. They set up an ACS system. They accept authentication from anybody, and they're up and running. So this is one of the hot topics for doing this. Now, service bus relays. This is what I mentioned earlier. With a service bus relay, I thought I took the build out. Oh, too far. With a service bus relay, you can keep your receiver, which is the one accepting the request, you can keep that on premises if you want. And what the sender will do is they'll hit a website, and the website's actually just an access point in the service bus front-end nodes. It'll accept the request, find out where it's headed for, and then relay the request to you. Now, this kind of gives you a service-oriented architecture based in the cloud. It's like it's a service bus that provides a little extra layer of protection. So one of the things I'll talk about more in the hybrid scenario is adding a layer of protection to your data center and getting the unwashed masses of the internet away from you. Okay? Are you looking for power? Yeah. These seats up front have power strips. Oh! I was trying to be helpful and I got busted. All right. So this will allow you to basically, you might have some ports or something open on your local data center, but you don't want to advertise it. All the unwashed masses go to the service bus and don't realize where it's going on the back end. Okay? So this allows you to expand that out pretty rapidly. Okay? Now, the hybrid scenario. This is the one most relevant to Australians if you can't get over the perception thing. People are normally okay if they know the data's staying here. What a hybrid application does. It allows you to keep this stuff on premises down here and this stuff in a public cloud. Now, there's a couple ways you can do this. You can synchronize the publicly available data into the cloud and then let everything happen in the cloud. This is very efficient. All the components are in the same location in the cloud. You get the scale out of all the levels of the application. It just means you have to do this data sync thing. Now, this data sync, you only want to put declassified data in the cloud if you're going to store it there. Now, this is if you can't get over the perception thing. The key to this is that first bullet point. You have got to have a good data classification strategy for this kind of a scenario to work well. Now, that should be easy because you need a good data classification strategy anyway. There are so many times when I've gone and I've talked to customers and I've seen their databases and the way they're putting their systems together, and they put everything in the same database. It doesn't matter what classification it is, and they rely on the front-end application to decide if the user should see it or not. Please don't do that. If you have something above HP data, highly protected data, and stuff below HP data, go ahead, stand up another virtual database. Separate that stuff. What you can do is you can set up a data sync scenario to actually take the declass stuff and synchronize it out to the cloud for you, keeping all the classified stuff on premises. Okay? And you can do this through views, Tor procs, or whatever it takes to actually, you know, pull it apart and send it up there if you want to. This will improve a little performance for your public cloud-facing systems. Plus, you get to take advantage of all the rapid elasticity, scale out, and all that stuff. Okay? you need to try to move your user interface layer and your business layer to the cloud, because those are largely just compute. You don't really store data there. It's compute. So stop spending money on local servers. Move that up there. We're going to save some money. Even per server, you'll save money doing that. Plus, it adds a layer of security to your system. Right? At this point, direct access to your data center and all of its juicy secrets has been moved to a public data center that is probably better equipped to handle things like that. Right? People often miss this part about going to the cloud. They don't realize that you're now adding what is effectively a service-provided DMZ. Okay? If you use Azure Connect on this back end over here, which is these blue lines, that is a point-to-point IPsec, IPv6 encrypted tunnel. If you set that up and you move your UI layer, your touch points to the public cloud, you no longer have to open your data center to anybody else, to the general public. You will get people off of your network. This increases your security posture 10 times, if not more. If people, we've done some sessions in the past here at TechEd where we show you how to get to a DMZ, find a vulnerable server, establish account, use that account to do the reverse proxy, to establish account inside the firewall, and then wreak havoc. I've done that demo several times. Jesper did that demo here. So if you can keep people from even getting to the servers in your network, you're far, far better off. All right. For those of you who don't know, up until about 2 years ago, I was a security consultant. I was a hacker for the good guys. So I spent all my time doing that. And I'm a big fan of that. If nothing else, get people off your network. And the data still stays on-premises in a nice, unopened data center now. Now, there's also you can do it from service to service. So if you don't want to do the data sync, if you really don't want any data stored outside of your data center, what you can do is either a service bus relay or a service-to-service relay. And the service-to-service relay, where you put up these service endpoints in Azure, that allows you to do pre-processing. If you want to have a service that accepts the incoming requests, it chews on the data, it pre-processes it, it validates it, it makes sure it's clean and tidy and ready to go, packages up the final data request and sends it down to your data center. This is a great example of how you'd want to do something like grant submission or tax submission or anything that's a form type of submission where you're collecting data from people. Do this because you can do all the pre-processing in the cloud and the compute instances, and then when you've packaged up the data they've submitted, you send that down to your local service that'll put it in the database for you. Here's a scenario where there is zero data stored in the cloud. Plus, you get the processing advantages. So kind of three different levels of a hybrid application. Okay. Now, will this solve the data sovereignty problem, you think, pretty much? You have the master database on-premises. You always have access to it. You can actually find the data, go in their database, and rip it out of the sand if you want to or whatever. Data stored in-country in your data center. Increases your security by decreasing your attack surface. Who doesn't like this scenario? Somebody's going to have a particular question that I'm waiting for, right? Yes. Mr. Mexia. This can be a problem if your applications are architected to do a whole lot of very frequent network calls. Because it's a non-trivial thing if this data center is in Ireland. You have latency, right? So when you're designing these kind of applications, there's kind of this new model for world-class network internet-based applications. And we talk about having a chunky conversation and a document-based language. So you're going to send a document in as your parameters. Don't send a string of parameters. Don't try to do request parameter things. Send in a document with your parameters. Do all your chewing, all your work. Send a document back. Don't make a call every time you want to get a new record out of the database, because you're going to take the latency hit on every single call. Right? So think chunky conversations. And also, as much as I'm a fan of the OData scenario, where you have a massive bunch of data, like in our case, the Genome Project, the Esri data, stuff like that, and people pull it out with no data call, OData, I want three records of four lines And the OData overhead's like this. All the metadata, all the information about the relationships and all that stuff. But if you serialize those three objects as a JSON JavaScript object notation serialized package, you get just what you ask for. So think about documents as inputs in one call and sending a JSON response back. So you have small payloads and you don't talk very much. Thanks. And Mexi has actually done some of this stuff. They do a lot of service bus relay stuff and a lot of work like that. All right. The moment Chris has been waiting for. I was going to ask her a bunch of questions and make her come up here and talk, but I got carried away. So Chris is actually one of our SharePoint experts in the Canberra branch. I'm not a slouch with SharePoint, but I always ask her because she knows how to do this. And we've put together a bit of a hybrid application demo, and I want her to walk you through it, and she'll show you what's up with the demo. Okay.
Okay. So I guess the rest of the session is going to basically take you over the demo Rocky and I have been built. As Rocky has said, I am a SharePoint consultant. I work for Microsoft Consulting Services. And based on my accent, you can tell I'm from camera as well. And most of my time joining Microsoft, I've been working with the government, federal government. So this Windows Azure, the hybrid architecture things is something I'm really passionate about. Because my specialty is in SharePoint, so this demo is going to have a very strong SharePoint flavor. But I guess most of you sitting here use SharePoint in your organization.
Does anybody here use SharePoint?
Who don't?
Yeah.
Probably that's easier. Any hands raised? Oh, okay. So 1, 2, 3, 4. Risk higher. I'm watching
right.
You guys.
All right.
Okay. So what I'm going to do first is I'm going to give you a visual of the art of possible of how you can possibly implement the hybrid architecture in real life. Okay. This is the demo architecture diagram we have been built. What we have in here is we have on-premises SQL Server database and a WCF web services sitting right here in our convention center. So it's definitely on-premises. Okay.
If you want to clear the fog, you can go to the HP stand and actually look at the rack that the database is sitting in if you want. See if you can figure out which drive it's on.
Okay. So what we're having really simple here is we have a product database which have all the product information. And all our WCF service on-premises doing is basically get product from the database. That's what we do it here. And then we have a WCF web services hosting in the Windows Azure platform. So all this web service do is really simple. It's calling only one method, which is get products from our on-premises WCF web services. Okay. And on your right-hand side, we have three consumers. And like I say, this is a SharePoint, you know, based demo, and we basically have SharePoint on-premises. I'm going to show you how from SharePoint on-premises, we're going to consume the WCF services from Azure. And the second one is we have Office 365 SharePoint Online, because we did get a lot of questions from our customers saying, look, we have a lot of partners using Office 365 nowadays, and if I want to share data with them, how I'm going to do it? This is one of the options how you can do it. Okay. And the last one is we're going to show you Windows 8 applications. The reason why we want to show the Windows 8 applications is because this is only app. Rocky can write, okay. So let's just.
Hey, she's right.
Okay, so let's just going to jump into my virtual machine. Okay, before I get into the code, the code is really simple. When you see it, it's only two lines of code. But I'll just show you how this gonna work. So this tag at 2012 is on my on-premises SharePoint implementation. Remember, this is actually hosting on my local laptop. Okay.
So this is more like a business-to-business scenario, where you may have a business partner that has a SharePoint installation. You want to share data between them, or scale that data out to multiple customers who may have a SharePoint installation, and then you'll be able to share this with them through these plugins and things that Chris is going to show you. And in this case, the actual local SharePoint site is on this machine. So she's running that locally. We're going to go all the way to Singapore and back to this machine.
Okay, so it's really easy. I'm just going to type a keyword.
Easy for you to say.
And all it does is calling the WCF web services and return to me a data grid with data within it. Okay.
What did you do, Dre?
It's metal.
Metal with a T.
Thank you.
We don't have Olympic medals as products in the database.
Let's give it a try another time. There you go.
Do an interesting one like tires, T-I-R-E-S. It's an American database, T-I-R-E-S.
This one?
Yeah. And then take the S off. Sorry. I only do Windows 8 apps. I don't know how this thing works.
All right, so it works, okay. So we just pump into the code. So it's really simple. What I do is I add a service reference, which is really the service endpoint of the WCF services in my project. This is basically a white part, you know, within SharePoint on-premises. And what I did here is I basically saying, okay, let's create a WCF instance here, and I call just the only one methods I have is based on the test box, whatever the input I have. So then it's banding the data into the data grid I have. So that's really simple, two lines of code, and get you to call that WCF services. It's nothing really rocket science. Okay. So I quickly move to the Office 365. So this is the Contoso Office 365 implementation we have. This is the Office 365 tenant I've provisioned. You can see this is Office 365 is because this is the name, okay, I'm having. What I'm having here is a SQLite application. For you who use SharePoint or you understand concept of sandbox solutions, you will understand that Office 365 is really a public cloud offering. It's actually software as a service offering. We do have limitations when we deploy our customizations into the Office 365. So in order to call that WCF services from Azure, what we did is we actually create a SQLite project, and basically I can show you. This is the WCF project, the SQLite project we have been creating. So exactly the same sort of implementation mechanism. We basically first have the WCF instance, and then the only difference is we make a asynchronous call instead of synchronous call. So you can see that's the only difference from coding perspective. And what we have here is after we compile, we have a zip file, basically it's a SQLite. So from this stage, I don't have anything to do with SharePoint or Office 365. Then I will take the zip file from the compile of this project and basically upload it. I create a document library called SQLite. Yeah, you can see I basically upload it as a normal document and I take the shortcut of it. And on this web page, I add a SQLite web part, which is taking the URL of my zip file in my Office 365 website, and this is what I get. So it's really, the coding perspective is really minimum, and we'll have the same result getting from the WCF services. Okay.
Once it pre-compiles.
Okay.
So search for something else interesting.
You think I search Rocky issue?
That's not going to come up.
Okay. Any suggestions?
Well, search for products in the database. Okay, go on. I'll show them later.
Okay, cool. So now we're moving to the Windows 8 app. What we're having here is
Alt-Tab works really well. I've got to harass Chris because this is actually her first TechEd presentation. And I know she's nervous.
I am.
So I'm really making it worse. Watch this little trick.
Cool. So this is the Windows 8.
I didn't say, nobody said I made good Windows 8 apps. It was late. I decided we should add this last night.
And what we do is still the same mechanism, calling the same web services on the cloud, and it basically returns to me the same data.
Now, one of the things I want to show you real quick, and I'm going to kind of invade Chris's space, but if you look at this, some of the products we have are metal sheets, and some of the other products we have in the database are, in this case, bicycle frames, right? So it's calling the service. Now, that response time is not bad, right? That's going from a Windows 8 client on my laptop to the Southeast Asia Azure Data Center, back to here in the expo hall, accessing the web service, pulling the information out of the database, routing it back through the Singapore data center to here. And that's not bad latency for a simple call like that, right? So when you're thinking about this, do be efficient, but it really isn't as bad as people think. And if you have static content, you can always forward cache it in what we call our content delivery networks, which are in Sydney, if you want it really fast in Sydney. So another thing I want to highlight about the idea of these Windows 8 apps and these services, with these modern apps that we have coming and Windows 8 phones, HTML5 websites so you can put stuff on an iPhone or an Android phone, couple lines of code, it's the same lines of code for each one of these applications. And you can add this capability and reach all these different devices. Imagine implementing the search contract. So, and I was trying to do this last night and the DNS crashed and I couldn't finish the demo, but imagine implementing a search contract and being able to search for products from here through your application. Right? I'm not going to get search results for blank, but you get the idea. So it can make this very powerful while your data stays local in your database. And you can reach all these different levels. Okay? Carry on. Sorry.
Okay, that's basically what we actually want to show in our demo. Mm. So I think just to summarize.
It's a fairly simple demo, but we stripped it down to just the essential parts. None of that data goes off-premises, except in transit, which we know about. The only place it's ever stored is in a database we control. So if you're worried about data going to the cloud, you don't have to move it there. Right, keep it local. If you're worried about data in transit, see the past 15 years of history to understand how to fix that. Okay. We have no public access to the database itself. The only thing that talks to it is our Azure web service. The only way other people can get to that data is through our controlled channel, and we're letting Azure take care of the bad guys. DDoS isn't a problem for Azure, right? We've got great big network pipes, specialized networking equipment to handle it. And you can get all those extra bits of protection for you as well just by using Azure or using a cloud provider. Did you have more stuff to say?
Okay, I think just repeat what you just said.
Okay. Go ahead, repeat it. No, that's all right.
Okay, I think it's just a good thing about it. We only show you three sort of consumption scenarios, but you can have more. For example, you can add your Windows forms, you can add your even Windows phones, whatever, to consume the WCF services hosting on the Windows Azure. And the good thing about it is you can actually scale it out. So basically, on your peak time, you can scale multiple servers quickly in a short period of time, and you can only see only one that sort of things run in a day, or only run for a week. Yeah. That's extremely good when you're in, for example, a tax office. Mm. You know, so for example, people submit their tax returns, that sort of things. So,
Cool. All right. So questions and answers. We kind of been doing the question thing as we went. And if you want, I'm going to go hang out in the expo hall in that speaker lounge community area if something comes up and you actually want to pursue the idea. Then we have to go through all this stuff, right? Related content. You guys are probably sick of these slides by now, aren't you? There's a lot of demos. Find me in the speaker area. Yeah, it's all common sense. Stay here for more Azure. Sign up at windowsazure.com, and there's a free trial offer if you want to play with it. Sign up for a free trial. Put your services out there. See how it works. See if it's something you'd want to do. All right, go ahead and do the free trial. And all these decks should be available for download, hopefully very soon, if they get them all up there like they should. Please fill out the eval. You can win one of those mice. And it's actually pretty cool. It's got the four-way scrolling with gestures and things. And I read them. In fact, I'm going to read all the Azure Track ones just to make sure we get everything back right. And, of course, you want to win a helicopter ride? People actually are winning them. It's true. It's happening. So tweet that if you want to win one of these helicopter rides. Okay? and then ubiquitous 10 line videos, and done. Whew, 11 o'clock, we did it. Thank you very much. See you guys. Have fun tonight. Have a lot of fun tonight, because I don't have to do a session first thing tomorrow, so it's all right.